Hi guys, Owen here. Just bringing another How We Rolls. This is one I've recorded probably the guts of 2 months ago by the time you hear it. It's with Daniel Kwan of Asians Represents. Real interesting guy. Me and Daniel met at D&D Live. We had some interesting conversations. Just got along really well. And he has doing a whole load of things in the RPG world between designing games, teaching kids through RPGs, helping people with mental disabilities with RPGs, just develop some social skills. Asian Represents is a really cool podcast about, you know, representing Asian people in media. And this is a really interesting take, and he's done a lot of work in the RPG realm, so I thought it was something you'd enjoy. If this is something you enjoy, please let Daniel know. He mentions his Twitter bio. Just jump on Twitter, tell him, look, enjoy the interview with How We Roll, and just show him some love. It's a real cool guy, doing a lot of good work. And just a creator I'd like to support, so hopefully you guys enjoy it. Here's How We Roll with Daniel Kwan of Asians Represents. Okay, folks, welcome back to How We Roll. This is a rolling with Daniel Kwan of Asians Represents. We haven't done one of these in a while.
What's up?
So, Daniel, welcome aboard, I guess.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I think our second, maybe third non-cast member. So they started off as kind of getting to know the cast members. Do you want to tell us a small bit about you and what you do and Asian Represents, I guess?
Yeah, I am based in Toronto in Canada. So, I mean, we're not too far from each other. for the past 14 years, I've been involved in using tabletop RPGs for education in the largest cultural and natural history museum in Canada called the Royal Ontario Museum. Since 2011, I've been teaching a program there that uses RPGs like D&D, Pathfinder, and like a variety of others to teach kids sort of history, science, and social skills. I run an organization with two of my friends called Level Up Gaming, and we help adults with autism develop their social skills using D&D. I design games through Dundas House Games, and then, of course, Asians Represent, my podcast that I co-host with Agatha Cheng on the One Shot Network. We kind of talk about issues that we face in the industry, problematic content, and, of course, you know, highlighting the contributions of Asian creators all over the world.
So a small bit involved in RPGs then, just a little bit.
Just a little bit, just a tiny bit, just a tiny bit.
I'm going to get into the kind of, I was going to say representation stuff, the Asian Represents and the work side of things in a little bit, but first kind of, just personally on your own level, kind of what is your history? What was your first hook into RPGs? What made you stick around the guts of what sounds like 20 years almost? Like, when did you fall in love again? What's that side of it?
I mean, it's a funny story. I played my first RPG at the museum that I work at, in the very same program that I'm now teaching. I was 10 years old. We started playing third edition D&D. Yeah, my mom signed my brother and I up, and like not knowing what D&D was, I had no idea what to expect, and I remember playing. I made an elven fighter. It was a super generic character, but you know, I got hooked. And ever since then, I just played a ton of D&D. I ended up volunteering for the program, becoming like a teaching assistant, and now the instructor. And you know, it's interesting because soon, because of my other sort of career commitments, I'm gonna be handing the reins to one of my assistants, who is also one of my students. So it kind of like passed the torch.
So it kind of goes on as a real sensei, kind of Padawan type situation, is it?
Oh, very much so. Very much so.
So did you just go in then originally kind of, your mom was just taking you to like a history camp? Like, were you a history nerd, or just it just kind of fell together and you fell in love with it that way?
Yeah, you know, like I was a history nerd. My mom, I mean, I have a master's and a degree in archaeology. My mom just wanted to put my brother and I in a camp, and she thought that would be educational. She tried to put me in like engineering camp, and it kind of sucked. I hated it. It's like super Asian.
As a man with an engineering degree, I don't see that being fun at all.
No, it was like, it was the worst. And all I wanted to do was like do something completely different. So I would like read like I would read sci-fi and fantasy books during the camp, and I would be that guy who's like, I'm not going to participate, I'm just going to read these books. And then she put us in D&D camp, and then that was it. She was just like, you know what, let's just try this. This is the only camp they have for your age. Go for it.
Make believing an elf is a lot easier than doing equations and, like, graph paper, you know?
Oh, my God. Yeah, and I mean, like, that camp somehow managed to make rockets uninteresting to me.
So it started off with the museum, and that was a D&D game, was it? D&D 3rd edition, you said?
Yeah, it was D&D 3rd edition.
And from there, then, did you get your own group? Did you meet friends through that? Like, have you, what else, how have you gone from D&D 3rd edition playing other RPGs? What was the kind of growth that way?
Yeah, I mean, at that camp, you know, my brother and I, we made friends. We all, like, started playing together outside of the museum, and we all got jobs at the museum. It's this weird little, like, community. We all got jobs in the museum, and I was playing D&D mostly, almost exclusively as a GM up until maybe 5 years ago when I guess word of my program had kind of reached the internet and people started talking about it, and I started to go to more conventions, and I decided, you know what, I need to get back into playing again. And so I you know, started to get friends together, and we started playing very regularly. And yeah, that's kind of how it evolved. I went from, you know, playing a lot as like a teenager to not playing for a little bit, and then playing again. It was weird. I guess being the teacher and being the person in charge of the program kind of prevented me from playing.
Yeah, I can see that. Joe has a similar effect of, he runs a podcast, so he never gets to play for us, I guess. In terms of, like, effectively that became the day job then, by the sounds of it. Did that take any of the gloss off it? Was there days when, like, I don't want to roll another campaign down a dungeon of, I don't know, the pyramids or whatever way you were doing it for a history museum. Like, did it ever become more of a day job than a passion?
I you know what, at times, yes. I mean, you have to deal with the bureaucracy of working at an institution. There are a lot of people who, you know, don't want the program to be there, but the program makes so much money, it actually keeps a lot of the other programs afloat. It's extremely popular. I think last summer for all of our programs, we sold out in 24 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, it's immensely popular. It has the, you know, what's interesting is that, like, you know, all the students, they come and they stay in the program, and then they kind of grow up playing D&D with my staff and I, and then they become volunteers, and then they become staff. So this summer, a whole new generation of my former students turned volunteers are now becoming employees. And
that's probably a good buzz.
Yeah, and you know, one of my former students turned volunteers, turned assistants, turned lead assistant, is now going to be taking over, and it's super fulfilling. And but yeah, there were times when it felt like a job, but that's why I kind of moved into doing like the therapeutic work and the design work and the podcasting to keep it fresh.
Yeah, I mean, like, I have a similar experience in my life, and it's not around D&D, but I was. A swimmer was my sport, and I loved swimming, and I became into life-saving, and then became a lifeguard, and I ended up actually managing a pool that was a lifeguard. But yeah. I now go back home, and I see some of the kids that I taught swimming at 10 years old, and they're working as lifeguards, and some are like pool managers, and it's weird to think that you had that effect that clearly I wasn't an asshole, I didn't turn them off swimming, you know? See, for lack of a better term.
That's really funny, because I was a swimmer as well.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I was like training for the Olympics.
Wow.
When I was in high school.
I tried my best to train to get there, but I was a short, round lad, which isn't a very aerodynamic or hydrodynamic shape to be going through a pool in. But I used to love it, yeah.
Yeah, I now hate swimming because of that. You know, I had to go. I was training like 7 times a week. There were days when I'd get up at 5, go to the pool, then go to school.
An hour and a half, 2 hours, yeah.
Then go back to the pool at the end of the day. And so D&D was kind of that, like, oh, I have to go volunteer at the museum and in high school because, you know, it's D&D time. I guess I don't have to go to the pool.
Yeah. It's funny. I was the opposite. I used to be the same. I do, yeah, maybe between 10 and 14 hours, depending on what time of the season it is. But I never, it was my opposite. It was my escape from school and study. And it was funny. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So that kind of gives you your personal history in D&D, which is, I would say, probably one of the more unique I've heard talking to anyone. And we had a really good conversation at D&D Live, and this is kind of what got me into... First of all, it was just a good conversation, so I thought someone great for the show. But you had so many different aspects, and you've touched on a few of them. The first one I'm going to talk about is probably your podcast, because it's a really cool concept. So do you want to just kind of give us, I guess, the elevator pitch of Asian Represents and what you were hoping to achieve through the show?
Yeah, I mean, if you were at D&D Live with me, you kind of look around and it's just like, where are the Asian people? And that's how I kind of feel when I go to conventions. And I'm like, where are the Asian people? I remember going to Gen Con last summer and kind of looking around and being like, every time I saw an Asian person, I was like, whoa, because it was just like they weren't visible at these convention scenes. They weren't visible in the design space, but I knew that they were there. So Agatha kind of approached me. Was like, hey, I want to start a podcast, but I don't know what to do it on. This person, said that they could do it with me and we could talk about Asian issues. Would you want to be on board? Because I'd been podcasting long before Asians Represent. I have another show called Curiosity in Focus, but it's not gaming related. Okay. And I was like, okay, you know what? Like, I'm totally down. I'd always wanted to do just a pure gaming podcast to talk about, you know, the games I love. Yeah. And I said, I'll do it on one condition. That person can't be on the show. Because that person who had wanted to do the show with Agatha and I wasn't Asian. But they said, you know, I can talk to all of the, you know, the white creators who create problematic content, and I can be that intermediary. And I was like, no, that's the problem. You can't be
I
that.
I could talk to the evil people for you. That's kind of coming across as.
Yeah, and you know what, like, you mean well, but that kind of perpetuates the problem in just a different way.
It's quite nighting a bit, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And I mean, that person is a great person, great member of the community. But I was like, if Agatha and I are going to do this show, it has to be us. And so we started Asians Represent, and I was like, I get to interview all of these awesome Asian people that I know, you know, use my platform to, you know, uplift their careers and uplift their work and create this big community. And that's what it is. Asians Represent is a community for Asian creators to highlight each other's work and show people that we exist in this space and show people, you know, what's wrong with their work. Like, why is Oriental Adventures, you know, a very, very offensive book to us? And that sort of thing.
It's a great first episode to check out, yeah.
It's still our most popular episode.
It's like, yeah, so an example, and one of the most striking moments, I remember moments of the D&D Live, there's lots of things of the show that was amazing. But when we were sitting down talking, yourself, myself, POC Gamer, we're just talking about, I think, archaeology and games and being nerds, basically. I was going to say Asian kids, that's disrespectful. They were young adults, but, like, I'm a little bit older than a lot of people at that convention. They came over all excited and, like, almost like how you described the Gen Con instance of you finding, like, this oasis of an Asian person in a desert of white neckbeards. Like, they were so excited to see you and they recognized you and they grew, like, a foot taller. It was just a really cool thing because you could see how much Asians represent meant to them, because they obviously came as probably two of maybe the only Asian friends they know in a game, and they were just so buzzing to see you and get pictures with you, and it was just a really cool moment, you know?
Yeah, that was, I wasn't expecting that, and at that same moment, there was this other guy sitting at that same table with us. He was a white guy, and he was like, oh yeah, two of my players at home listen to your show, and I was like, it was that moment when everybody kind of realized I was there, and I was like, oh my god, I didn't expect it at all.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not something... Our show, we have... Well, actually, I was going to say we don't really have any underrepresented people, but I guess, actually, we have Curran, who I see as an Irish guy, because he's as Irish as a potato, but he's actually of Indian descent. Like, his father was born in India. I think Curran may have lived there for a while. But he sounds more Irish than I do, so I kind of forget that he is. But I've never thought of that perspective of, you don't see people on bigger streams, you don't see them at conventions.
You see cast members. I mean, there are some amazing people out there, like Lisa Chin, Maris and Kat from D20 Dames are both Asian.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of people out there, but I think Asians Represent is the first show that has an entirely Asian cast and production crew. I mean, we started doing our own actual play where we're playing Masks, a New Generation, which is like an indie superhero RPG. And we're trying to basically just create the kind of content that we want using the themes that we can relate to. And when we see people respond to our episodes saying, I mean, there was this one episode where one of the characters goes up to another and says, "Did you eat? Have you eaten?" And I don't know if that means anything to people in Ireland, but in Chinese culture, if you go up to somebody, like a family member usually or a loved one, and you say, "Have you eaten?" That's like a sign of affection.
Oh, yeah.
And
you can't go to an Irish household and like not be offered food. And even if you're not hungry, you kind of have to take it because they'll be offended you're not eating, you know?
Yeah. And so, you know, having these little like sayings or phrases that are culturally significant to us in, you know, an actual play has been really important to people. And it's been really cool.
Touchstone, yeah.
Yeah. Now we're going to move into after D&D Live and after, you know, playing with all of you folks, I was like, you know what? We have to do our own D&D show. So we're planning a D&D actual play with an all-Asian cast set in a fantasy China that I'm writing using, like, drawing on my academic background. But then also, you know, using parts of that conversation that you, Graham, like POC Gamer, and I were having about, like, the monk and how the monk should maybe be called the martial artist and how we can change these classes in 5th edition to match an Asian setting to make everything kind of thematically coherent.
Yeah, that was one of the things in the conversation we had. Like, there's so many things that... Something when we started off the podcast, it was four or five UK and Irish-based guys, generally middle-class. Like, we don't have many disadvantages at all. Curran maybe gets some bit of racism in Ireland occasionally. The rest of us are like, I'm white, freckly, blondish. Like, I've no issues. We were really conscious of... We make dick jokes. We're not bro-y, but in terms of D&D, we're a little bro-y, you know? So we've gotten Lisa in because we were very conscious. We want to have a proper representation. But listening to your guys' show, and I know you're saying it's about reaching out to Asian communities and giving them hope. There's a lot of people, like, who aren't in that situation can learn, because there's things I'd never have considered of different things. Like the Gen Con talk that you had with the girl who wrote, is it The Journey Back from Bassan?
Yeah.
Like, that's a Cleo. Perspective I'd never thought of.
What Asians represent isn't just for Asian people. It's for everyone.
Yeah, and it's definitely worth, especially like for DMs creating worlds and stuff. Like, we had, you're having a discussion about, in that same episode actually, non-Asian people playing an Asian character. And we actually had a campaign on our show, which the arc ended up dying because people moved, but... We had this abbot in a monastery that was like the wise sage generic character, and Joe said he was going to play it kind of as a wise Japanese, you know, master, kind of martial master. I was kind of going, all right, how are you going to play that? Well, I'm going to do a Japanese accent. I was kind of being straight with him, going, Joe, I don't know if it's the right thing to do. This could be ropey. And it was only after he did it, we said, look, we'll see how it turns out in the thing. To me, it sounded respectful and genuine. And it was only after that I found out Joe actually lived in Japan for like 4 years and was like semi-fluent or a little less than semi-fluent in Japanese. So
Oh, cool. He
came from a place of understanding, probably.
Yeah.
And a lot of the points that you discussed in that about kind of intent and taking in, you know, consideration of where you're coming from and what you're trying to convey with the character. Does it need to have an accent? Can you just talk in your normal accent and people can picture him as Asian?
It's
something that probably... Definitely I wouldn't have considered when I was playing games.
Yeah, I mean, like, the accent isn't the only thing that makes someone Asian.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that was a big thing. But yeah, you're right. Unfortunately, people just kind of, they think that's the only thing.
Yeah, like, my fear, to be fair. I know, like, I don't want to be sounding like I'm throwing Joe under the bus, and he genuinely, I think, did a good job on it, and... We wouldn't have released, and we've pulled stuff that we realized on an edit, like, that's just not right, we've made a mistake here in the heat of the moment. Like, my fear was he'd come out like Mickey Rooney in some, like, it hot, like, I was very worried how cartoonish it could turn out, but he came at it in the right way that way.
Yeah, I've never actually listened to a podcast and seen, like, heard people use these voices. I've only ever seen that sort of thing at a convention.
Here is where I might have an experience that you don't have then. Because the only place where I can relate to this is there's an Irish caricature out there of drunken leprechauns or something along those lines. I don't mind the Irish people are drunk thing because genuinely our culture is massively into drinking to a certain point in some places where it's an issue, but like it is a part of our culture. So I don't mind people portraying Irish people as drunk. What drives me nuts is the Lucky Charms voice that comes out because that is not Irish.
Right.
And that grates me a small bit. And it's not so much, it's not, because as I said, I'm not in that position of oppression, I guess. It offends me more so that I think, like, this isn't a genuine voice. And it sounds like if anyone from Ireland is listening, they're going to turn off going, they don't know what they're talking about. I can only imagine when it feels like it's coming from a more hurtful place. Like, I don't have that history of people, you know, being racist towards the Irish. It's generally the Irish are the cool, fun party group. Like, where you get a positive spin on it, I guess.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. I mean, one of the things for me is, like, I'm not very good at accents and voices, so I never fall into that trap.
I'm same. I get made fun of for my voices are an octave up and an octave down of my own voice, and that's it, you know? So, in terms of that show, you're talking about moving in. I've seen you starting to play one or two episodes. I'm halfway through the first episode of Masks. You're now moving into that actual play and kind of giving people characters they can buy into. Is that just kind of giving the Asian community some sort of so, you know, there's like an acquisitions inc and all these people that people look up to. Are you kind of giving someone that they can aspire to be and kind of give them ideas how they can play their own characters?
Yeah, that's kind of what we were trying to do. But also with our Masks actual play, we really wanted to do something different by normalizing certain practices at the table and in actual play. We wanted to keep the production and the recording very transparent. So in the episodes, we talk about safety tools. At the end of the episode, we if you haven't gone to the end of the first episode, we actually do this thing where we call them Rose, Thorns, and Wishes, where we kind of go around and we say our favorite thing about the recording, our rose. It could be, you know, this moment somebody had when they were role-playing. We all go around with thorns and we kind of say, what did we not like? For instance, during one of the recordings, I was role-playing and we were gaining a lot of momentum in this scene and the GM kind of cut us off. To put spotlight on somebody else, which is fine. But then when the GM returned to me, the moment that we had been building to got passed over for a different scene and we never got to resolve something. So in the actual play, we're kind of normalizing these conversations that friends have when they game together and improve as players and GMs. And then, of course, we say wishes. We say what we want to do for the next one. It could be, you know, I want to role play better. I want to be more descriptive with how I set the scenes and things like that. And so we want not only to have an actual play that touches on Asian themes and has representation in its class, in its like cast, but also just shows good role-playing and shows, you know, what a respectful table can be.
Yeah, and I would say, so at D&D, the game we were in, we'd never used a traffic light system or a veil. We've not done anything like horns and wishes, kind of in an official way, like for our show. We've probably done it because we're conscious that we have a show and we want to make sure everything's respectful. But we hadn't an informal kind of Facebook chat where we talked about things, but things like that, for me even, just learning by being at D&D, it gives a structure to those kinds of conversations. And even now with the Rose, Thorn, and Wishes, we do that after every show, but we don't structure it. It's what was good, what was bad, and it could be a mesh of information from three or four players in a Facebook chat as opposed to a nice, concise way of doing it. So they're actually good tools, which I'm probably going to take away myself out of this, you know?
That's awesome.
Yeah, so you're basically kind of like showing what a best in class or a good way to kind of bring to the table what people can use. Like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, we want to just, and it's not the only way that you can roleplay. We just want to show another way. I love, you know, like I really love Relics and Rarities. I think it's a fantastic show. I'm glad that I got to see them live. And what I really like about that show is that, you know, the Deborah, the DM, likes to bring in a lot of homemade puzzles and stuff.
It's so cool.
And props.
That's the first time I've seen him live. It was so cool.
It was so cool, right? And that's one way to do it. Whereas if you watch Critical Role, you know, they're all really good at accents. Matt Mercer is amazing at that. And, you know, they have the Dwarven Forge miniatures and everything. And that's another way that you can do it. And then us, we don't use miniatures at all. And I mean, we just recorded a new episode yesterday, and I think I rolled dice twice.
Yeah, you're very similar to us in that way. Starting off, because a lot of us were RPG noobs, effectively. But we've really grown into trying to resolve it with RP. And it's more fun that way, one. I feel like you're a compelling argument or persuasion, and the DM just goes, actually, yeah, there's no need to roll. He'd probably go with that. That's the best way for me to play it, but it's not for everyone. You get the guys who are more wargaming and they like the dice rolling and stuff, you know?
Yeah, I like the say yes or roll the dice if I'm the GM. I'm like, you know, if the player wants to cross the bridge and, you know, them getting across the bridge isn't really going to affect anything else, you don't have to roll. You cross the bridge. You do your backflips, because if you fail, you're still going to have to get across the bridge.
yeah, we're not going anywhere in the story. We had one character like that, or one player like that when we first started. He was like, I want to look around the bar, and he'll say, so I'm going to roll for that. And you're like, no, I've got the description here, I'm going to tell you anyway. You can see the bar without having to roll every time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely. I like that, because I think sometimes the dice rolling can kind of interrupt the flow of the role playing.
Yeah, and there's nothing worse than, like you said, that break of momentum, it can kill it. It's like, you can capture magic in a bottle, and it doesn't take a lot to knock you out of it while you're in a good roleplay flow, but dice can be definitely one of the things that does.
Yeah.
So, I guess on that, the next thing that I'm finding really interesting in listening to your show, you talk about it a lot, is your Dundas West Gaming.
Yeah.
You talk about different games you've released. So I think Zany Zoo was your first one, and Ross Rifles is...
It's coming out.
As far as I am in your show, you haven't released it, so I don't know if you have actually released it in real life or not at the moment.
Oh, no, not yet. Zany Zoo is our first release. Actually, today we just released a 5e adventure.
I saw that. Actually.
That I wrote. It's inspired by, you know, historical China and aspects of Chinese pop culture. So I'm really excited about that one. And Ross Rifles is our big project. We have this... It's actually really funny. We have this D&D campaign setting that we have been using at the museum that me and my two sort of co-owners of Dundas West Games, we had been working on. And we were like, okay, we want to publish this, but nobody knows who we are. So let's let's come up with something small. And we decided that we would write a game about World War I and, you know, the Canadian forces. As we wrote this game, and, you know, we all have different backgrounds. Patrick, my co-author, his great-grandfather actually fought in the war and was Irish. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, and then Daniel, his family also fought in the war. My family didn't. But in my in doing my other podcast, Curiosity and Focus, I actually did an episode on the Chinese soldiers who fought for the Canadian Empire, or I guess the British Empire, for the Canadian Expeditionary Forces. And I learned about the first known Canadian-born Chinese soldier to fight and die for Canada in the First World War. And I thought his story was so incredible that, how am I going to get that out there beyond my podcast? And I thought, well, if we're writing this book about World War I, I want to include a lot of representation and diversity in the history that's in the book. And so our World War I game is about, you know, kind of undermining our conventional thought of what a Canadian soldier looked like in the First World War.
Yeah.
And, go ahead.
Because you described it a couple of times in the show, and you kind of went in the episodes I've listened to, you talk about that side of it, that, because, yeah, I've no connection to Canada in any way, know your history to any great degree other than you're part of the Commonwealth at some point.
Yes.
And the idea of, you picture a Canadian soldier in World War I, picture him in any war, even still now, you're not going to be thinking of, especially a guy who in World War I has probably only moved from China to Canada recently to end up in World War I, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And you wouldn't picture that, or you wouldn't picture the African Canadians or the Indigenous peoples who fought in the war. And so we wanted to really put that in our book. And when we announced it, it kind of just like blew up. And we play it at every convention that we go to. It's got like a huge following of people who are very excited for it. And we're just kind of taking our time, making sure we do it right. A big part of it was actually playing the game with military veterans to make sure that the mechanics and the content were respectful.
Authentic, yeah.
Yeah, we went to we went to Ottawa, like capital of Canada, to go to their war museum so we could actually handle the Ross rifles and the Lee Enfield rifles in person, so that we could make sure that our history of the rifles were accurate and that the way in which we wrote the book and the descriptions of the guns and how people acted and used them was as accurate as possible.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean,
we went all out.
It's my kind of like in school, like, was, even though I didn't actually take it for like the end of high school or anything, but like history was this kind of thing I just enjoyed reading, and it just sounds like a different, interesting game. So I'm sure there's guys listening to this and you've got the more detailed focus, let's call them nerds, I guess, in an affectionate way. Kind of space system have you, like, what's the actual nuts and bolts in terms of, have you developed your own system, are you piggybacking on another kind of system, or what way are you looking at it?
So we're using Apocalypse World, so we're using the Powered by the Apocalypse system, so it's okay. Very very narrative, sort of very narrative heavy, but you know, compared to other Powered by the Apocalypse games, we have like really brutal combat. I mean, it is a game that's meant to be violent. You are meant to fight. People are meant to die around you. It's meant to be hard. It's meant to...
World War I, basically.
It's World War I. And anybody who's ever read about World War I knows that it was a brutal war. And we're not pulling punches with it. So while we're using that 2D6 system, you know, we've added other mechanics to it to make it feel authentically brutal, but also appeal to the time period and the challenges that the soldiers faced.
That's really cool. I mean, it just sounds like... I like kind of cool different spins on RPGs, and like some of the ones, like, we actually started off our show and how we got, I think, quite good at role-playing. We did a lot of Call of Cthulhu stuff, which, okay, it's fantasy-esque in Lovecraft, but you're essentially, at the end of the day, you're humans who die so easily in that game.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot easier to fall into role-playing it, you know? And that's what that sounds like to me. It sounds like, even describing it in some of the things you talk about in the show, it sounds like a very relatable, you know, they're kids at war, a long way from home, in a horrific situation. It seems like something you can fall into and relate to really quickly.
Yeah, that's really it. And, you know, I can't even remember how many sessions of Ross Rifle I've played at this point. And, I mean, I'm just excited to put it out there. It's a complete game right now. We've fleshed out everything. It's just a matter of... We want to go into the Kickstarter with the book finished so that we can get it into people's hands faster. That's kind of it right now.
Okay. You don't sound half excited or eager to get going at all with it, Daniel.
I'm excited. We're going to launch in October this year. We're taking our time because we want to make sure that we do it right. We also want to make sure all of our team members are kind of in the country at the same time. I used to work as an archaeologist, and so I would travel a lot. I actually wrote a section of Ross Rifles while living in China, and I would spend basically 10 hours a day in a wet trench. And so, like, Ross Rifles felt very real to me when I was writing it. One of my other co-authors right now...
Appreciation for it, yeah.
Really, it really does. And one of my other co-authors right now, he's in Georgia... on a dig studying ancient wine. So we want to make sure we're all back. We're all ready to go. One of the things that we want to make sure we do right is shipping and everything like that. So we're taking our time.
Sounds good. Once it comes out, definitely let us know. We'll help push it as well.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
So in terms of Dundas,
you said,
is there three of you have written Ross Rifles, or what's the actual, how big, small, what does the company look like, out of curiosity?
It's small. We have, right now, it's the three of us are the core members, myself, Patrick Keenan, and another Daniel named Daniel Groh. Daniel is our business manager. He handles all of the business side. Patrick is in charge of publishing. I'm in charge of marketing. And Patrick and I do the majority of the writing. We have one contractor, like a long-term contractor, who's our graphic designer and artist. And then we have another contractor whose contract is up because he was my co-author on Wolf of the South.
Okay. Which is your DMs Guild 5e module you've just launched, right?
Yep.
All right. That's exciting stuff. I mean, how did Zany Zoo go down then, out of curiosity, which was your first kind of foray as a trio, wasn't it?
It was our first foray as a trio. It went really well. It was a game we designed to look like a pamphlet. It was meant to look like a zoo brochure, so that when you hold it, it looks like you've actually gone to the zoo. There's a map of a zoo on the back and all the text. It went really well. It's really popular at conventions that we go to. It's meant to be a family-friendly game with like almost minimal prep. All you need are cue cards and some D6s, and it's a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun recording an actual play of it for our website, DundasWestGames.com. We did one where we were all aquatic animals trying to escape this massive aquarium facility, and one of the guys who was playing was like, you have to kind of know about the animal you're playing, because you have to write 10 facts about them that dictate their abilities.
It's educational as well, then.
Very. And one guy was like, well, I want to be a shark, but I don't know anything about sharks. And he was like, can I just be Jaws? And we're like, sure, you can be Jaws. So he wrote, I'm Jaws. And then he wrote all his abilities. He was like, well, can eat boats and things like
strong,
that.
He's strong against small boats, yeah.
Yeah, strong against small boats, weak against scuba tanks. so we designed it so that it would be educational, and we have this idea of making more sort of Zany Zoo spin-offs using the same thing. I have this idea of actually making a version of the game where the GM is the predator and the characters are the soldiers, like in the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie Predator, and it's Predator.
So not so much a spin-off. It's not going to be that family-friendly, but it sounds like this.
No. But I guess you could call it Alien Hunt or something like that.
I mean, it sounds like a great game, because it sounds like something kind of, even on the way to a con, if you're on a big long train ride or like a plane ride, you could almost do it, because you don't need much prep.
Oh, yeah. Almost no prep, except for, you know, you just need your phone if you want to look up some facts about an animal.
That's cool. So, yeah. I guess the other thing you've done, and kind of what it sounds like you've met a couple of your Dundas colleagues through the museum or teaching, have you?
Yeah, I met both of them through that. They were they are both my students and staff members. One of them, Patrick, who's like my writing partner, is going to be taking over my class at the ROM as I kind of transition away from the museum. Daniel, he works at a bank, but he was also one of my employees at the museum. And that's where we met, and we became friends, and started, you know, playing games outside. And we're like, you know what, we should just, let's publish this stuff. Let's put this out there. And that's how it started. Dundas West is actually like the part of Toronto where I live. Yeah.
That sounds like something, because Dundas to me just sounded like it was Tolkien-inspired or something. It just sounds, I don't know, it could be like a suburb of Hobbiton to me.
It sounds fantastical. No, it's literally the subway station, like the train station that's near my condo. And we did the majority of our writing here, and so we were like, let's just call it Dundas West Games, and that's what we went with.
It works. It works on many levels. I mean, yeah. Anything I name, if I have anything in the RPG and I need to name it, it's going to be like, let's just convert something to Irish, because it just sounds more mystical to anyone who doesn't speak Irish.
And the spelling, too.
Yeah, I get that a lot. So, in terms of the other side of it, then, of your work, you talk about the work you've done, obviously, with the museum and kids, but you said you also work with, is it autistic adults?
Yes.
With Love Gaming, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, that.
So how did that come about, or is that something is it an organization that was there, is it something that you developed, or...
No,
what's the kind of lay of the land there?
It kind of came out of the ROM again. So I started Level Up Gaming with two of my friends who were both teachers at the ROM alongside me. And I had this student at the museum years ago, and he was 11 when he first started with me. And his mom came in and said, "Hey, you know, he had Asperger's." And
okay.
his mother said, "Hey, you know, if we're not sure if this will work out, here's my phone number. If this doesn't work out with him, just let me know, and you know, I'll pick him up, and you know, you won't have to worry." And I said, no, don't worry, like this will be fine. You know, I treat all of my students like normal people, and I think that's the big thing, and it just takes patience. And so, you know, I was like, okay, well, he's going to need a little bit of extra help, so I'll be his GM, because I have a staff of GMs. So I'll be his GM. And we played our first game, and he got hooked. He loved orcs, and he was playing as like a half-orc barbarian, and that was his thing. He just went and killed everything. But, you know, as, you know, he spent time in the museum with, you know, his fellow, like, students, with my staff, myself, learning about history and playing through different storylines, his characters evolved with that too, and he started to play more sensitive characters, or he started to play characters that didn't fight, and he used to come in with pages and pages of notes on, you know, our campaign and the world and his ideas about, you know, his character's race.
Super engaged. That's cool.
Super engaged, and his mom was like, you know, he's reading and writing now, and we're going to transition to him into, like, you know, just like a normal high school instead of being homeschooled. And
wow.
Then it kind of hit me one day. I was traveling to Greece to work, to do some archaeology work there. As you do.
humble brag, but okay.
Humble brag. I lived in this weird old British manor with like a view of the Acropolis from my bedroom. And I just spent my days in a lab, and then my early evenings, afternoons, wandering the streets of Athens.
I was joking about the humble brag. Now I'm not so much joking about it. Okay.
But I was flying out there, and I got an email from his mom, and she was like, "Hey, he doesn't want to come back to your program next week." I had a substitute teacher who was covering for me. He doesn't want to come back. And I was kind of reading, and at first I was like, "Oh no, what did we do wrong?" He had been with me for 4 years, and she's like, "He doesn't want to come back because he doesn't feel like he wants to be a student anymore. He feels like he wants to work for you now."
Oh, right.
And I was like, "Well, we'll make this happen." And in the airport, I started like crying. I was like sobbing in the airport, waiting to board my plane, and he ended up working for me, and it was wonderful. And now he goes to like a normal high school, and he actually just like published a book.
Wow.
I told two of my coworkers that, and one of them was training to become an occupational therapist, and the other is a spec ed teacher. And the three of us decided that, you know, we should take this and turn it into something that could help more people. And adults with autism don't have a lot of options when it comes to programming. Everything kind of ends when you're 18. And so we thought, well, let's create something for adults. And so for the past 3 years, we've run, I think, eight to 10 week sessions of Level Up Gaming. That's been it. It's been awesome. We just wrapped up our spring session this week.
Whoa, that's amazing.
Yeah, it
really
was,
is like,
it was awesome.
Like, even just the story of like you and Greece in the airport, like it's just touching. Like, to be fair, again, being a swim teacher, one of the things with kids with Asperger's and being kind of tactile learners and engaging and stuff, I used to actually specialize in doing private lessons with either adults who are frightened of water, but also special needs kids. It wasn't that I was in no way trained to do it. It's just I had a name in the pool that this guy is good with kids who are, you know, be it social issues or social anxiety. And it's amazing how quickly, for someone that's kind of, even their parents' words, kind of shut off from people, how if you can get through to them and it's the connection is just so strong, it's kind of, it's weird. It just brought me back to a weird place about 20 years ago, you know, when I was 18.
Yeah, I mean, once you just need that connection in that special place, and instantly you could change somebody's life. Like, that's really cool. Like, I mean, I don't even know how I would approach teaching somebody who is afraid of water to swim.
that was, I mean, someone with their full mental functions and everything intact, that's 40 years old and has been terrified of something all their life, is harder to deal with than a child that's never been able to socially interact with even their parents. Because you could slowly coax a child who doesn't know any different, you know, over a couple of years of kind of memory out of themselves. Breaking someone's fear of water who's had the bad experience as a 5-year-old or something is such hard work. Again, very fulfilling.
Oh, I imagine.
But you get people who, yeah, like, you see the fear of God in their eyes and you've a grown man holding on to it. I used to be in the water teaching swimming as well, so.
Wow. But
again, it's fulfilling. Like, I've gone back. It's my hometown is where I used to teach, so my parents still live there. And I'll go back and I'll swim in the pool myself occasionally still. And there's one guy who I'll never forget his first day. He was just, like, literally holding my hand, getting into a pool that in the shallow end is 3.5 feet. And this guy's about 6'4", and he was terrified. He now goes to the pool, like, twice a week and can swim 25 to 40 lengths in an hour. And he has been doing it for the last 8-10 years, and it's just... It's weird. He still hasn't bought me a pint or anything, but, like... No, he's a good buddy of mine. I still see him every so often and say hello. But it's... Like, that family are always going to remember you for what you've done for that kid.
That's amazing, like, your story. Wow.
Well, it doesn't beat basically giving a guy a job who's now published a book, to be fair. I mean, it's easy, I suppose, when you have a passion for something, which clearly you have for RPGs and obviously teaching, so.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
I mean, it's interesting how we can take things we're passionate about and kind of help people. And yeah. And I think what was cool about D&D Live was that everybody there is passionate about the same thing, which is awesome.
What a beautiful segue. Next
yeah.
thing I know, it was D&D Live. It's almost like you're a pro. Starting interviews for your show if you hadn't already been doing them for a year. So, D&D Live. For me, it was my first... Well, we did a podcast convention that basically was a first-time convention in the UK only back in February. But the first, like, legitimate big event that me and Joe ever did was D&D Live. So, I was going to come at it with probably rose-tinted glasses to a certain extent anyway. I'm going to the US, seeing all these stars I hadn't seen. I enjoyed it. There was positives and negatives, which I haven't discussed yet in the show. But as a whole, how did you find the whole experience? Or, like, I guess your rose thorns and wishes for next year. How's that?
I want to hear yours as well.
They'll come. No problem.
I think what I liked most about it was meeting... I love meeting members of the community. I don't want to separate, like, oh, you know, the talent and the fans. I just love meeting everyone there. I thought the event was really cool because everybody was just kind of mingling. And that's one of the things we were talking about. It's just like, oh, wow, look, it's Joe Manganiello just walking around.
There was very little velvet rope, like, with the important people behind it. Like, there was none of that there, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
none of that. And it made for a very intimate event where everybody kind of felt more comfortable. Like, it didn't feel... Like, I didn't get the impression that people were being creepy to the celebrities. It was just like, oh, I really like your show. You love the same thing I love.
Yeah.
I thought that was great. I thought... I really enjoyed the conversations we had there. Like, everybody, just talking to that reporter, Eric...
Yeah, he was super cool. That was a really good conversation.
That was a fantastic conversation, and just, you know, getting to meet you and Joe and playing D&D, that was cool. Like, we got to go to Hollywood to play D&D.
Yeah, I got home to my family. I was like, wait, so how was the event? Like, the event was cool, but I actually technically performed in a studio in Hollywood.
Yeah, like, I feel like I've peaked.
Exactly. I mean, I was embarrassed to tell people about my little podcast because I thought I was too cool to be boasting about D&D. And I was like, hey, everybody, listen. Listen what I did. You know, I've become that guy.
Yeah, I was telling my girlfriend, I was like, I went to Hollywood and I got recognized. What?
Yeah, so is there anything then, I guess, that you'd like to see? It doesn't have to be a negative. Is there anything... more a question that kind of came up a lot when we were there is like, should it get bigger or what can they change next year? And that was coming from kind of like your Chris Perkins isn't D&D staff. We're asking that of fans and what we'll deem talent, but I don't like that term, you know, the performers, we'll call them performers.
Performers, yeah.
Like, what way would you like to see it go, or would you change anything about it?
I don't think it can get any bigger. I think if it got bigger, it wouldn't be what it was. And I don't want to sound like a gatekeeper or anything, because I think this was both like the most exclusive event ever, because it was incredibly expensive to attend, but also like one of the most accessible ones, because most of it was live streamed professionally to the world. So I think that part made, you know, everybody was able to participate. Everybody was able to kind of see these live shows. Like, people were able to watch the Relics and Rarities show that we watched, like, from the comfort of their homes. But then if you really wanted to, you can go and pay to be there. I think getting any bigger would make this show very different from what it was. I think the one thing that I would change would be to have more of an international presence. I think it would be really cool to see a little bit more diversity in the performers who are there. I know that there are a lot of people in like Southeast Asia in particular who are really into D&D and make actual play content. And I think giving those people an opportunity to come to LA to be present at D&D Live would show the world who's watching it that D&D is very much an international hobby. That's what I would change. And that's what I want next year.
Yeah, because it's a comment I made a couple of times, but I do think D&D does feel, you can't say, but it can't. I was going to say it feels very like a US kind of UK English speaking world thing. But even outside of that, it feels very much, and I don't mean to be offensive, but like what I'm going to deem as white neckbeardy nerds, like that's, it has that image because that's how it's been portrayed in media from the 80s and the Satanic Panic and all that. It was white guys in their basement playing it.
Yeah.
And they have an opportunity to bring more to that, bring be a South American and Asian, African podcast. Now, it's difficult. I don't know of many that are out there, but it's definitely something they could look at.
Yeah, and I think that would be great. I think it would be really good for the community. Like, I want to meet more European, like, podcasters, because I want to see what that hobby is, like, what the hobby is like over there. I mean, like, you folks have castles.
I have three castles in my city, and my town that I grew up in, which is only 2,000 people, has two castles, yeah.
You have castles. Like, I can't, like, imagine, like, if I grew up seeing castles all the time and then playing D&D, that would just be so different for me. Like, does having castles in such close proximity affect how you play?
Not at all. Like, I don't even consider, like, they're so commonplace in Ireland that I don't mean to sound privileged here, but it's just something it doesn't even register. It's like when you go around Rome or Greece and you see all the ancient ruins, the locals don't realize how amazing it is to have them there. Like, I'm getting married, like, I'm engaged.
Oh, congrats.
Legitimately, an option for me that isn't too expensive is getting married in a castle or on the grounds of a castle. See, it's not extraordinarily expensive because there's that many of them around, you know?
See, that's so cool.
Exactly. Like, when we did Dragon Talk, we were talking about it, and Greg Tito and Shelley kind of said something similar to, you guys have so many castles over there, we'd love to do a D&D live in a castle. And I made a joke of, guys, I can send you pictures on Twitter of like 4 or 5 options, we can scope them out. And in my head afterwards, thinking, I could actually do a series where like once a week I can post castles a week, and it would run for comfortably 3 months without me running out of castles in a driving distance from my house.
I mean,
on my commute to work and stuff, you know?
I'd look at that, like, I mean, like, when you're describing castles, what's in a castle, what does it feel like to be in a castle? Like, I've been very fortunate to have been able to see a handful of castles, but to live near castles, that blows my mind, right? Yeah. And to have these different perspectives and to have creators from, you know, parts of the world where castles are commonplace come to a part of the world where there are no castles would be really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I actually did a big trip in the west coast of America last summer, and you see things like Hearst Castle and stuff. I was like, oh, this was built, I keep forgetting because it's only 200 years old, in the 1800s, and it has like a couple of castle-like turrets and some like crenellations along the roof made of wood. I'm like, this isn't a castle. I understand you're calling it a castle, but I kind of forget how lucky it is to be over here, you know?
Yeah.
there's your improvement for D&D Live next year. Put it in a castle.
Well, I thought about that. I was like, oh, I was talking to Victoria, and I was like, what if they did it in a castle in Europe? But then I thought, like, well, if they're going to live stream it, how do you do Wi-Fi and all that in a castle? And how do you live stream from a castle with all of these other things? And I thought, oh, that would be a logistical nightmare.
Probably as well as they did Saturday morning in Hollywood, to be fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not to be shady.
No, it's true. It's true. I mean, like, the studio could barely... I mean, there's one of my thorns. Like, how did that happen?
I can tell you why I think that happened, you know.
What do you think?
And I didn't want to say it too much on the day, but... So, for people who weren't at the Indie Live, there was a setup there where our studio was either side of the road. There was one side of the road was a studio kind of prop department where you could change and get props and craft services were. And we were all sent in our package the password to that studio. If we wanted to use Wi-Fi, we were meant to go over there. The password for the studio where everything was broadcast from, there was a little reception area, which was one of the only areas that was backstage. But on that reception, they had the password to this studio is this. And I reckon the password got out for the Wi-Fi in the air, and I'd say everyone there was on the Wi-Fi and just choked it up, is my guess.
Oh, yeah, because it was just sitting on that little paper plaque.
There you go, yeah. Like, there's no reason for that to be out there. And then I couldn't get onto the Wi-Fi the second day, so I wondered if they changed the password and kick a lot of people off, you know?
Oh, that's true. Oh, there's yeah.
My little behind-the-curtain thing. Because I remember seeing that on the Friday, and I was like, that's a risk. Because we were all nerds there. We were all going to be on the internet, like, posting selfies and saying how cool stuff was.
Oh, because everything there was super cool.
Yeah, it was hard not to, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean... If it was in a castle, though, oh man!
If you ever come to Ireland, Daniel, you've got your own personal tour guide for the west coast of Ireland. I'll show you some of the biggest castles in the country.
Oh man, I would. Europe is one of the places that I want to explore more of because I think it's just not something I've seen a lot of. And we're talking about, I think Asians represent. We're going to try to go to Dragon Meet in 2020.
No way.
Yeah, we're going to try to do some, like, European stuff, but Ireland is one of the places I would love to go to.
In Ireland, it feels like if you come, you might visibly increase the population of RPG players. Now, we do have some stuff, but, like, hobby shops are hard here, because we don't have many cities in the country, so...
Is wargaming big in Ireland? I know it's big in the UK in general, but...
Like, 40K and stuff is probably... as big. Like, any of the conventions seem to have more war games and stuff either. There isn't really RPG conventions. Now, to be honest with you, I only got into RPGing heavily and properly 4 or 5 years ago, more or less with the podcast. Like, I was only playing for a year before the podcast.
Okay.
But, like, even in my university and stuff, there was a couple of different clubs and stuff, but there wasn't really, like, an RPG club. It was more, like, Blood Bowl and 40K type stuff, it felt like, you know, and Risk and all that kind of stuff.
Right. So, yeah, because I know that, like... In England, 40K is huge.
Yeah, game shop stuff is massive over there. Or Games Workshop stuff is massive over there. It feels like it's getting more... I don't know whether it's getting bigger. I think people are connecting more, and that's making it get bigger. Like, I think there probably was the fans underground, but obviously with the internet and podcasts. Like, I learned to play D&D through podcasts long before I played it.
No way.
I was listening to all these different actual plays and stuff, you know?
That's how you learn how to play D&D. That's so cool.
Like, I got 90% of the rules, and then I moved to Manchester in 2013, and through League of Legends, a friend of mine from Scotland said, oh, I know a guy from Manchester I play League of Legends with, and that was Joe. And it turned out he lived, like, 4 streets from where I was moving to. We became drinking buddies, and drunkenly one night I told him, you could be one of the greatest DMs in the world, we're gonna get you famous. Hammered. And legitimately, in a pub, 2014 or 15, I said, we'll get to Hollywood, Joe, it's gonna happen.
And you so did
a big,
it.
I told you so about four or 5 weeks ago to Joe, you know?
Wow. We'll make that it to Hollywood.
It was drunken hubris. I did think we'd have a semi-successful podcast that might, you know, it'd pay for the microphones we used. I didn't think we'd get to where we are. I'm confident. I'm not that much of a confident asshole, you know?
But you did it.
Yeah. And it was great fun telling Joe I told you so. It was so good. It was the sweetest I told you so I've ever had in my life.
We made it to Hollywood. We did it.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I guess, yeah, on the D&D thing, I don't really have much to add to what you said. I mean, definitely the coolest thing for me was the celebrities walking around. Like, at one point, I'm going around the vendor stage, and I'm looking at some of the minis, which aren't really my thing, but some of them are cool. And Deborah Wall is her name? Or from Relics?
Yeah.
She just... kind of walked up beside me. I hadn't realized she was there, and she goes, "This stuff is so cool, isn't it?" And I turned and I kind of like, I loved Daredevil, and she was in Daredevil.
Yeah, she was.
And I was like, I didn't want to like freak out and go, "I love your work." I was like, "Yeah, this is really cool. Just be cool. Just act normal. She's not weird. Don't make it weird."
You probably looked super weird.
I definitely did, but in my head, like, I nailed it. Sweating bullets going. But like, she was, and she was clearly a fan. She was so into it. She picked up like 3 or 4 minis, and she like had arms full of like different things. And she could probably just ask to give it to her. She just walked up and paid for it, and like that side of it was really cool.
Yeah, like, I mean, that's I was eating craft services, and like in the next table over, Joe Manganiello was just sitting there eating and chatting with his, like, all the Death Saves people about D&D, and I was like, this is so weird.
Yeah.
Like, I have no right to be here.
Yeah, I was over at craft services, and I was in the queue, and Matt Mercer just goes, "Hey, what's up, buddy?" And I was like, "Not much," and just walked on, because I didn't know what to say. I was like, he doesn't clear about the conversation, he's just saying hello, and I'm like, right, what do I do here? What do I do with my hands? It's like that Ricky Bobby scene in Talladega Nights. I don't know what to do with my hands.
Yes, yes. It was weird. The fact that we had craft services was really weird. And I don't want us to sound like we're bragging, but like, this was a legitimate event, and I feel like it really makes the hobby and, you know, our shows legitimate.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like when I think of D&D, like, you talk about that in school back when we were growing up, and it was like, "Oh, you play D&D?" And people mightn't even think you're that strange, but they're always going, "Weird, that game, isn't it?" Like, you know, what, there's no controller, there's no video element.
Yeah, it's just your mind.
Yeah, it's just, it was just, yeah, it was so bizarre. Like, it was such a legitimate setup. It was so, like, security was massive, everything there, just the amount of vendors, just how legit everything was so, like, you saw the cameras, the jibs, everything.
Oh yeah. Actually, what I think I'd like to see next year, I'd like to see more families.
Yeah, it was a really, really old group. Like, I don't think there was anyone there. It felt like there was nobody under there, like, under 26, maybe.
Yeah, no, definitely.
That might be the price point as well, though. I mean, it's $100 a day, wasn't it? $100 a day.
Something like that, I think.
Yeah, and I don't know if you could buy single-day tickets, so, like, you're forking out $300.
Yeah, that's a lot. What is that in Canadian? That's like, 500 Canadian?
I couldn't even tell you in euro.
That's like 405 Canadian dollars.
Probably not far off that in euro as well. I mean, and I wonder, like, again, not to sound gatekeepery, there was a small amount of fans there. There might only have been 300 fans, I'd say, maybe.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder, because of that, like, it's a high price point, so, like, a casual fan isn't going to buy a ticket to it. There isn't a lot of tickets there. Like, they sold out quickly. But the knowledge of people there and kind of just the intelligence is the right word, but like the depth of knowledge, the depth of understanding of what every show was about, what all the performers were about. I think if you lower that price point or like release more tickets and make it more accessible, it might get a bit more weird with the talent and performers. You know, you're like saying that kind of creepy fanboy-esque thing you get.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's this double-edged sword. I mean, people who really want to be there will be willing to pay a lot of money to be there. And the people who are casual fans, you know, like, I know we keep using Relics and Rarities because it's a great show. People who like Relics and Rarities, you know, but aren't willing to fly to LA and pay, you know, $300 US to go, can watch it for free online and not miss out.
Yeah.
And I think that's the beauty of it. Anybody can attend, and it's just the degree to which you want to experience D&D live that changes.
Yeah, and it's what it was really cool as well for me on the scene, because I did a terribly unsuccessful podcast around League of Legends and gaming a long time ago. That world, I met other guys who were trying to podcast. They were small, none of us made anybody successful. But it feels very much like you're competing for views, whereas all of us, I didn't even meet all the podcasts that were there because there were so many there, and like people did their own thing in LA as well. But everyone you met was like, "Oh, this is what your show is about, that's really cool. I could take this from you and use it in my show. You should try this from my show." Like, it was really cooperative. We're all still in that Discord where you're guesting on my show, I'm talking about guesting on someone else's show. It's really a rising tide kind of lifts all boats, which isn't common in a lot of communities, like, because essentially it is very easy to look at, we're all competing for the same fans.
But yeah,
there's none of that in the group of whatever,
because
12, 15 podcasts that were there, you know?
Yeah, because I think everybody, you know, you like the personalities, you like what they have to say, and if they're on another person's show, I mean, that's just more content for you to consume.
Yeah. And it is mad, like...
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, go on. No, go ahead.
Like, the one thing that struck me is, I was waiting to meet an asshole at some point at the weekend that never happened, because you kind of expect at some point someone... Just a clash of personalities somewhere will happen, but like there really was, I didn't see anyone have a falling out with anyone. I'm sure there might have been one or two, but it was just a massive loving.
No, yeah, I agree. I don't know of any drama or anything that came out of this event.
No.
Yeah.
It's unusual, like, you know, it doesn't happen in this day and age. Not sound like my granddad or my mother or father, but like drama kind of goes everywhere, and there was literally none of it.
Yeah, I mean, aside from the internet issues, it was an otherwise perfect event.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Dang.
I think that'll lead us into possibly my favorite part of these shows. We have fan questions. So I went to our Discord, and only briefly to the Asian Represents Discord, because I didn't realize you had one until about an hour before we recorded.
No, that's
so
okay.
One question from those guys. But... I'm going to ask a couple of questions from the fans, and then we end it with... we have two questions I ask in every episode, because it was asked... They were the first two fan questions I got, and I quite like both of them. So we'll end on those two. But the first one we have is a fan question from our Discord from a person called BCP. They want to know, what's your best war story from RPGs, be it your best moment, worst moment, funniest moment? What was that moment of magic that's always stuck with you?
Oh my god. I think my answer is actually going to be, it might disappoint you. I have two. One of them just happened. We were recording our new Masks episode, and my character just had this incredible moment. I won't say what it was, but I will say, I mean, they'll have to listen to the show because I don't want to ruin it. But there was a moment. I was actually playing D&D with Victoria. Agatha and I had driven out to Kitchener, Ontario, which is like an hour away from Toronto. I had just worked a long, long day at the museum. And I drove out to this small convention, and we did this live show for the Broadswords. And Agatha and I were like guest players. But the convention was so poorly like managed, it no longer exists, that there were only two people in the audience because they forgot to advertise that this was happening.
Oh.
And we had the most epic game of D&D ever. It was amazing. We were in like this boat race, and we had built this like, can I swear on your show?
You can fucking swear all you want, buddy.
We built this like shitty ass raft, and the barbarian was like holding up the mast, and like two other characters were holding the barbarian's legs, and then the GM was like, there's no wind because this is like a river race. So I was like, I'm a monk. I'm going to use Flurry of Blows, and I'm just going to like kick really fast and generate wind. And for the majority of this game, we were just trying to propel a boat.
It was a 5-boat race, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I heard this on your show.
It was.
That's why I'm laughing.
It was the best. It was the best game of D&D I've played in such a long time, and I loved it so much.
Can I ask you one question?
Yeah.
Which I thought at the time, and now that I know you're a swimmer, I have to ask. So you started using Flurry of Blows as a monk to create wind. Why wouldn't you get behind the boat and just kick your legs as Flurry of Blows?
Well, that ended up happening. That ended up happening.
Because you said you created wind. I was like, what? And you said the same on the show. I was like, surely you could have swam.
But I really wanted to. I wanted the most ridiculous option possible. And did you ever play Street Fighter?
Like it did. Chun-Li wanted to do, was it?
Yeah, so I wanted to just do the Chun-Li kicks, and I just wanted to kick and generate wind and blow it into the sails. I think that was just the most ridiculous option possible, and that's what I wanted, and I did it. And like
having heard that story and having played with you with Fizz, you're definitely a very similar style player for me. It's like, what is the... If I apply logic to the nth degree, that it almost becomes illogical, and it's funny. What way can I play this?
Yeah, that's how I like to play. I like to have some serious games, but I just love to go all out with the hilarity on my character. For D&D Live, I knew we were going to hell, and I made a character who used water as a weapon.
With a sword of warning.
With a sword of warning. I was like, I could have.
My favorite part.
I could have picked anything, and I picked a sword of warning because I was like, this is just going to be funny. I'm glad that everybody's sort of playstyles matched up. But yeah, that was my favorite moment in a game.
That's a good answer. That's a great answer. So the next question we actually have three from Sketch Ferret. So one of our main contributors. The first one that she asks is a quick one. Do you prefer DMing or playing?
Oh my god.
Your favorite child.
Oh my god, that's a tough question. Right now I would say like I really enjoy playing because I DM a lot. Like I work as a DM for hire as well.
Okay.
And I really enjoy playing. But then there are also those games that are almost like GM-less, and I really love those. There's a game called End of the World Zombie Apocalypse, and I had been playing that with a group of friends, and we were playing it in Toronto. We had like a map of the city, and we were drawing out contaminated zones and everything, and the game started with us emptying our pockets and being like, okay, that's what you have. And we would actually trade off GMing as we traveled through the city based on who knew which neighborhoods better.
Oh, IRL knew what you mean.
Yeah.
That's true, then, is it? That's
brilliant. And that worked out really in a really fun way because we got to kind of mess with each other, but also create a very, very realistic feeling game. So in that sense, I kind of like both.
I think that's a fair answer. I mean, for me, because I'm a terrible... Well, I DM'd one game ever, and that was Everyone is John, which is basically... I can improvise this, it'll be fine, you know? I'm a player first, as everyone will know. The next one then is, what's a favorite character in a game you've played? It doesn't necessarily have to be a player, it could be an NPC, but who is the most fun you've had as a character in any of your games?
We have this character in our museum campaign. He's kind of... There's this whole idea that him and Fizz and are all kind of related, and there are these gnomish demigods that kind of walk our world, and they're all they have strange luck, and in a sense they're immortal, but there's this character named Fizzbang, and he doesn't really fall into any of the classes, but he just has this thirst for knowledge, and his thirst for knowledge often ends up with him meeting the players, giving them helpful information, but also he gets killed a lot. but like Kenny in South Park, he kind of just like comes back to life all the time. Okay. And so players who have been at the museum for a long time, they know that when they see a gnome with a giant backpack that's almost so big that he just kind of drags it, they know that they can get answers from Fizzbang, but they know that something might happen.
And he probably dies in more escalating, ridiculous ways.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly the shtick.
That's great. Then the last one from Sketch Ferret is there any monster in the Monster Manual you feel is underappreciated and needs more love?
Oh, yes. Great oh, question. Yes. That's an excellent question. My favorite monster is the Froghemoth. I love the Froghemoth.
I need to go to Google.
Yeah, Google it first before I continue. It's one of my favorite monsters.
Okay, go on.
I love the Froghemoth. I think it's so funny looking, and they're actually selling a miniature of it. It's very powerful, but it's just a ridiculous creature. I love the way it looks.
It's squid frog for anyone who's listening and isn't it? It's like it's got tentacles. It's a frog. It's frog legs. With a frog face, but huge tentacles, it looks like.
Yeah, but weird insect eyes almost, like that protrude from its head. I love the Froghemoth. In Pathfinder, I really love what they did with Leshies.
Okay.
You'd have to look that one up.
I'm going for it as well.
Yeah,
Aleshy.
L-E-S-H-Y.
L-E-S-H-Y, okay.
When playing with, with kids, Leshies are often, they think they're so cute, and I've done a whole campaign where everybody was a Leshy, and they're just, these, plant sprites, and they're so cute. And I think they need to be in more games.
Oh, they look pretty cool, right? They're, yeah.
Yeah,
they're like pixie size. They look really small. Like, there's no reference in the picture I'm seeing, but they look like they should be minuscule.
Yeah, they're small. Leshies are, I think they're small size. Yeah, they're always small, and they're fey.
They look mischievous and cool. I'm not even going to try and describe these, because there's a whole plethora of different looking leshies. They all look different and cool.
Yeah, there's a seaweed one. There's a sunflower leshy. There's a
cactus
gourd.
And mushroom.
Yeah, they're cool.
That's cool. That's a game I never played, Pathfinder, because I started off in 3.5.
It's the same thing.
Played a small bit of that. Played 4th Ed. Wasn't a big fan of 4th Ed, and love 5th Ed again.
I mean, Pathfinder plays very, very similar to 3.5.
It's 3.5 improved, effectively, isn't it? That's what people kind of say.
Yeah, it's an improvement on it. Definitely an improvement on it.
All right, and then the last question we have is from the fans, is from your own Discord, is Macaroni X, and saying, if you had to master one melee weapon in real life, it could be, so you master it in your real life, but you can choose a weapon from reality or fiction, what one would you like to master?
Oh, 100% the karambit.
Yeah.
100% the karambit.
Big fan, yeah?
Big fan.
Do you want to describe the karambit for anyone who's not recognized, who's been listening?
Yeah, so karambits are Southeast Asian knives. They're you see them in Indonesia, Malaysia. I did a lot of martial arts as well growing up. I actually I shoot bows pretty regularly. But the karambit is a kind of knife that's always fascinated me with the way it looks. It looks like a claw. One end of the handle, it's a one-handed weapon. One end of the handle has a ring where you put one of your fingers. It kind of secures it in place and lets you manipulate it. But it's just a really neat looking weapon. And I've never been able to really find a place in Toronto where I could learn how to use one. And
it feels like those classes might be illegal in a lot of places, to be fair.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very similar to the knives anyone plays CSGO, basically. A lot of those knives are karambits, basically.
Yeah, that's it. And I think in Splinter Cell Blacklist, Sam Fisher, his signature weapon there is a karambit. But it's really cool, and it's I like that weapon because if I was able to learn how to use it, I could incorporate it into my D&D games. It's just a neat-looking tool. But I know
didn't know where that was going to go.
Yeah.
If I matched that, I could just run Toronto. I didn't know what way it was going to go. You know?
I mean, I guess the UK, they have very strict laws on pocket knives.
Yeah, less so in Ireland, though, so I could be gangster with you.
Yeah, I carry a pocket knife just for work.
Oh, wow. Yeah, if you got stopped, there'd be questions asked in Ireland, but no, in the UK, they had a real knife problem. Guns aren't a thing in our countries, so knives are the weapon that kill people.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
You obviously get the gangsters, like it was real hard in criminals that have guns. Guns aren't as readily available or as easy to get as, especially in the States, you know?
Oh, yeah, especially in the States. In Toronto, there's some gun violence, but I would assume that there's more knives. I have a question for you, actually. I'm sure this is a question you've heard before. What are your thoughts on Conor McGregor? I'm a big MMA fan, and I've always wanted to ask, what do the Irish actually think of Conor McGregor?
Oh, well, there's two different questions there. So the first thing you need to know about Irish culture is, and a good example of this is probably Bono. We love people and we root for them and we want them to do the best. You'll see in the Irish fans in MMA, take over the MGM and all of Vegas for Conor McGregor weekends. Go crazy. We love when anyone is getting to the top of a game. And if they get to the top of the game and they win that belt. Once we start thinking they get cocky, I say we, once Irish people start thinking they get cocky, they start knocking him down a pedestal or two, and they enjoyed seeing the fall to a certain extent. Bono, there's some issues that he doesn't really pay taxes in Ireland, but he gets a lot of stick for being sanctimonious for all the work he does and how he thinks he knows best because of his Red charity and stuff. And similar thing happened to Conor McGregor, that before all of the criminal issues and court cases came out, people started knocking him.
Right.
So I was a big Conor McGregor fan, followed him to the nth degree, believed he'd, Turn the Tide against Khabib, all this kind of stuff. The more I hear about him, the more I'm like, you definitely, I think, are probably addicted to cocaine and doing some bad stuff. He comes from a really bad part of Dublin. He'll say it's a village, but really it's a suburb of Dublin. You know, it's kind of like saying Brooklyn or Long Island isn't New York. You know,
okay.
It's still New York. He says it's a small village, but it's a suburb of Dublin where there would be gangland criminals, and he was drinking in the pub that would be known as a gang pub. Now, it would be his local pub probably anyway.
Right.
And he was photographed with some of those guys, so he was a young guy. He made a shitload of money off the Mayweather fight.
Oh my God, yeah.
Like, if I was that age, it might be hard not to get into cocaine, to be honest with you. Like, there's just some people probably throwing cocaine at you in parties and everything else. But then some of the other stuff, like the sexual assault allegations, the rumors that he punched someone, but I think that turned out to be false. But, like, every story that comes out of Conor McGregor, I'm more likely to believe now the more that I see it going on.
Yeah, you know? Money so kind of corrupts.
It's harder to cheer for him. If a fight came along, I think I'd still probably cheer for him.
But, if he ever fights again, because he's got that proper 12 whiskey.
Yeah, exactly. That's printing money as well.
Yeah. Oh, my God. If I had $100 million, I'd yeah. still probably do what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's the thing. Just have a professional studio. That's the only difference.
Yeah.
The thing in Ireland, and it really drives me nuts about Irish people, is I don't know if it's a phrase you have over there, but it's the tall poppy syndrome.
No.
Basically, if the head gets too... So it's a gardening term. If you want to keep your flowers nice and level... If they grow too high, you pick the head off the poppy and it regrows at the right level. So you knock them down a peg, basically, once they get too high. Once they're the underdog, we're backing them and we're telling everyone they're the best in the world. Once they start saying they're the best in the world, we're like, all right, buddy, slow down here now. Don't forget where you're from, you know?
Oh.
Whereas I'd be like, he's the best in the world. Let's flick it. We don't have best in the world in many things. Let's boast about it, you know?
Oh.
That's my way of looking at it.
Okay. Yeah, I was always curious. It's one of the things I was like, okay, I'm going to ask about Conor McGregor, even though it's not MMA. It's not an MMA podcast.
Oh, look, this show is just about a chat and having fun. And I had this conversation with you, I think, over in D&D Life. People listen, they find your show for the content. They stay for the conversation and personalities.
Yes.
And that's why you're on the show. You're a good personality, so.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I listen to Joe Rogan, and for as...
I do too.
Yeah, like, he has a lot of things that I don't agree with, but he has some topics... And characters on that show that I'd never listen to because I wouldn't find that interesting, but he makes an interesting conversation because of his personality.
No, absolutely. And, absolutely.
Like, he's the reason I podcast. I just need to pick a subject I found interesting to podcast, and that was my theory, you know?
Ah, okay. That's cool.
So, yeah. So, that's the fan questions we got from the two Discords. The two questions that I've asked, I think, every guest on this show. The first two questions we ever got, and I can't think he's going to be upset with me. It's a guy from our Discord, and I always forget to credit him. But you know who you are, buddy. They'll call out in the next one. I'm so sorry. the two questions we get asked. The first one is probably the one that people seem to answer quicker, so I'll give you that. The Muppets, Jim Henson's Muppets. If you had to be a Muppet, which Muppet represents you the best?
Oh, my God. I've never thought about that. I have to really think.
I'm joking. People struggle to answer it, but everyone always comes up with an answer, and it's always interesting. It's an interesting personality trait.
Oh my God, let me... Okay, I gotta think about this. Oh.
Go for it. If it makes you feel any better, I'll tell you mine. The lads have always heard it, but mine for me is Beaker.
Beaker? Yeah.
I don't know why. I'm the slapstick comedy guy in our group. I tend to get into disasters on the show, so Beaker.
I feel like Beaker is the D&D character I always play.
Definitely. Based on the one game I played with you, I can see that.
Yeah, 100%. I think in real life... Ooh. I think in real life I'm kind of like Kermit.
I get that.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of like Kermit in real life, but in D&D I'm 100% Beaker.
I can see Kermit. You're trying to keep the whole show together. You're running all of the RPG groups.
Yeah. Kermit's just kind of like holding it together, and you know Kermit's going to snap.
I don't know what's snapping. I can see you'd be the producer of a Mad Muppet show.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely Kermit, like, but in game I'm definitely Beaker.
Yeah, like, to a certain extent, like, I play my characters a little... I don't obviously do the silly thing to the fault, but I definitely like pushing the buttons and making people laugh. But what people say then is Joe is the Professor Honeydew. He's very much like an order, and he likes to keep the world in place. So that's the way that the fans basically christened him that in our Discord. So it's, I like that duo for us. So then the last question then that comes up is, if someone was to write the story of Daniel Kwan and Asians Represent and everything you've done kind of an RPG, who would play you in the movie?
Oh, easy. There's so many. I mean, he's way better looking, but Steven Yeun.
Steven Yeun. All right. The name doesn't come to mind. Let me have a look at
this. He's on The Walking Dead.
Oh, yes.
Glenn. Yeah, he played Glenn on The Walking Dead.
Okay.
I would pick Steven Yeun. He doesn't look anything like me, but man, he's a beautiful Asian man.
Fair enough. So you just basically you just want to look super hot in your movie.
Want to look super hot in my movie. I think Steven Yeun. I think an older me would be. I feel like Randall Park's characters, or I don't know why I'm connected with like Korean actors. I'm not even Korean, but I think Randall Park's characters are I often connect to them. He's in that new Netflix movie, Always Be My Maybe, with Ali Wong.
Oh yeah. I like that.
Yeah, I like him too. But I think if I had complete creative control over who played me in a movie about my life, it would be Steven Yeun, because I want to look sexy.
I thought you were gonna pick, who did I hear you fanboying over in one of your
episodes? Oh, Will Yun Lee, Donnie Yen.
Is he? Oh, he's in Hawaii Five-0 and Lost.
Oh yeah, Daniel Day Kim.
Daniel Day Kim, that's his name. I couldn't think of the name.
Yeah, I'm not.
What episode is? But you just take a segue for about 3 minutes. You talk about how great this guy is.
I like crushing on these guys. I think Daniel Day Kim. If I got really jacked, I'd pick Daniel Day Kim to cast me. But I think Steven Yeun is more of my build, so I'd pick Steven Yeun.
You're the executive producer in this show. It doesn't have to be realistic.
If we're not going to do that, then Daniel Day Kim, 100%. Because then I want to look sexy.
You and me are different. I'm like, I don't care if it's not like me. This is what it's going to look like.
Well, who would you pick then?
I actually haven't thought about this, and it really upsets me that we've done this with, I think, every one of our cast members, or maybe missing one, and Joel is dragging his feet and doing it for me. So I've actually thought about this a lot. Personality-wise, I think Matthew Perry from Friends, because I make those silly jokes and sometimes they'd land horribly flat.
Okay.
Like so, that kind of character.
So his character.
I think that's kind of his character. When I see him in interviews, he doesn't seem a million miles from that either, you know?
Okay.
And then the other one, which is probably a bit too on the nose, I quite like Donald Gleason, Brendan Gleason's son.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
I'm not quite as ginger as him, but he gets the Irish thing down. I had, when I was younger, kind of touch of awkwardness in, which I kind of think he has when he does acting and stuff. So I think he pulled me off to a certain extent.
That's a good question to ask guests.
I think it's really interesting. And they were the first, they were literally like within the first three questions I got in the first episode when I asked the Discord. It kind of is a really interesting like self-assessment of your character. And some people like, they pick really insightful things. Like, oh, that's really clever. And it's someone really obscure, but you can tell they've obviously connected with them earlier in their life or somewhere where they've seen them on TV.
Yeah.
And then you see some people who, whether self-esteem issues or they're being humble or something, you're like, ah, buddy, you can do better than that. You don't need to pick, you know, someone from a Lifetime movie or whoever they pick, you know. Like, so it's interesting to see. It definitely kind of gives you an insight into what they think about themselves or what they're trying to get across in whatever story they want to told about themselves, you know.
Right.
But you're the jacked guy or the...
the jacked guy, yeah.
The guy just trying to survive in Walking Dead, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess. You really drew that out of me.
No, it's interesting. Look, on a whole, Daniel, it's been a pleasure doing the interview with you. I think our fans are really going to get a buzz out of it. And a pleasure meeting you and talking archaeology finds. I should have brought the story out about your rebar story, actually. That's a great story.
Well, we could save that for another time, then.
Definitely, that could be interview number two.
Yeah, well, I hope we get to meet in person again. Maybe D&D Live next year, or sooner.
Yeah, D&D Live next year, or a castle in Ireland somewhere. How's that?
Oh, I pick the castle. Pick the castle over D&D Live. Come on.
Well, I have cousins in Toronto's actually a place I want to visit. I lived with 4 and 5 when I was backpacking around Australia. 4 or 5 people from Toronto. And I always said I'd go back. We're good drinking buddies and they're great fun. But you know, when you're traveling, everyone becomes your best buddy and you just, real life gets in the way. So Toronto's one of those cities I want to visit.
Well, if you ever come.
Checklist.
Yeah, if you ever come to Toronto, let me, like, just hit me up.
When we get the Dundas Gaming Convention,
I'll come and
start playtesting some games.
One day.
Well, I think we'll wrap it up there, Daniel. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for doing How We Roll. Is there anything you want to plug and push out there to our guys?
Oh, I mean, like, listen to the Asians Represent podcast. I mean, my social media is, I'm sure you'll link that, but I have my D&D module, Wolf of the South, out on DM's Guild now, so I think that's it.
There you go, guys. As he said, the socials will all be linked in the description of this show. This has been How We Roll with Daniel Kwan of Asians Represents. We're out. Woo. Okay, so that was Rolling with Daniel Kwan, guys. Hopefully you enjoyed it. It's a really interesting conversation. Goes from everything from archaeology to his trips through Europe, what it's like to be an Asian person in RPGs, teaching kids and special needs people with RPGs, what should and shouldn't happen in the RPG world, you know, D&D Live. It's all really interesting stuff. A bit of swimming in there. Always interesting conversation with Daniel, and hopefully we might get another chance to do it with him in the future. He's just one of the many cool people I met at D&D Live this year. So I have a few more people lined up from D&D Live. We've one already recorded. Probably another 3 or 4 we're trying to arrange dates with. So hopefully you're enjoying this show. If you enjoyed this show specifically, go over to Twitter and let Daniel know at the Asian Represents Twitter handle. Just tell him you enjoyed the Rolling With interview. If you have anyone you'd like to suggest for an interview, you can hit me up on Twitter at HowWeRollOwen. Owen is spelled E-O-G-H-A-N. You can also put fan questions there for me. I'll announce who I'm interviewing on the day. If you want a bit more notice than on the day, you can join us on Discord. The pinned tweet on my Twitter will have our Discord link. There you can have a chat with us about our episodes, give us feedback, what you think. You also get a bit more notice on who I'm interviewing, so you can get a fan question in a bit easier than on Twitter. And for anyone who's given me feedback on this show, it's kind of my little side project Rolling With. And I know Joe's on a couple, but it's something I'm really enjoying. Not getting them out as quick as I'd like, just real life getting in the way. But hopefully we can make these a bit more regular. And just all the feedback's been so positive, and hopefully I can get a bit better with them. So if you do have any advice or any criticism, constructive criticism preferably, let me know. For anyone who's shown support to me, the show, or anything in the past 4 years, you guys at D&D Live, patrons are amazing, helping us buy equipment and everything. Anyone who's listening, especially at this point when I'm rambling on, really appreciate it, guys. This has been Rolling with Daniel Kwan. Thank you very much. I'm out.